Hi everyone. Okay, so very much looking forward to the next session. It's with great pleasure that I introduce Professor Danny Dorling from the University of Oxford, who's going to talk about disadvantage and inequality through vignettes and life stories of seven children. Okay, thank you, Danny.
Thank you.
Oh yeah.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's an honour to go on after Professor Bo Powell. I'm going to try to get you to think about a simple problem. Supposing you had to describe the UK and children in the UK. There's about 14 million children in the UK. You could say it's all very complicated. There's all these different kind of lives. I'd had to write a very long book, and even that wouldn't encompass it. But that kind of answer, it's all very complicated, isn't really that satisfactory. And I'd suggest it isn't actually that complicated. You're all children, most of you. Some of you are 18. How many are 18? Just give me a, put your hands up. Be proud. You've made it through another year, okay, minority. So most of you are still legally children. You are experts on children. You know each other. You gossip about each other. You've got an idea. I could probably ask you some questions about people's lives and you might get them right. I won't do this. I'll make sure there's lots of time for questions at the end. But there'll be things you won't know. Partly because, of course, you are not a typical set of young people. You're the ones who've ended up being interested in sociology, sitting in an arts centre in the University of Warwick. So for a start, just looking at you, I think there are more young women than young men. Now let's get on to the more embarrassing stuff. I suspect, on average, you're better off than the average child. I'm not going to ask you who had no holiday last year, because you're not going to tell me. But if you didn't go on holiday last year at all, a holiday is a week away from home, not staying with family or friends. We've got definitions for these things. If you didn't go on holiday last year or the year before, well, you're the same as one in three young people in the UK. One in three people of your age do not have a holiday. Other young people might have four or five or even six holidays. Think about the long summer. You might have to go off your parents. Could be a bit annoying, but at least it's free. But somebody else might have a house in Devon that you can all go down to and it's fun and... Then there might be skiing and something else, and you want to get your holidays in before you go to university and so on. So if you're in the best off 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6%, it's about multiple holidays. I'm interested in inequalities. Inequalities in general. And I'd argue that the key inequality, the one which will most determine the most important things in your life, is money. Now, this is related to other inequalities. So if you're black, you're far more likely to be poor than if you're white. But most poor people are not black. Right? That's the kind of nuance. Most people in the poorest 10% of British society are white. But there are a disproportionate number of people in that poorest 10% who are black, and an unusually small number of people are Indian and Chinese. And we can go on and on quoting hundreds of statistics at you to argue various things, but each statistic is just a particular take. So what if you're trying to generalise? I decided I was going to have seven children in my generalisation. The lovely thing about working in a university is you can really just do largely what you want within the constraints of how much you're approved. My children, I gave them names. They're Anna, Brandon, Candice, David, Emily, Freddie and Gemma. Gemma's our posh kid, Anna's our poorest kid. I'm going to leave plenty of time for questions. That's the cover of the book. And those little bars relate to the average amount of money each family has to spend a week after they've paid the rent or the mortgage. The UK now is incredibly unequal. The most unequal country in Europe, give or take Bulgaria. The most unequal it's been since the 1930s. But for you, this is normal. You haven't known anything else. Most of you haven't lived somewhere else. You can't time travel. You can't have my childhood in the 1970s when the UK was the most equal country it had ever been since hunter-gatherers. When we were the second most equal large country in Europe to Sweden when we were Scandinavian. That was what I grew up in. It was almost a different world to what you've grown up in. And it will change again. Here's how it changed. 1960, 70, 80, 1990, 2000, 2010, here. This is the Gini coefficient of income inequality, which you're probably taught. It's just a measure of the size of the gap between us. I can't normally say that to an audience, but you're sociology students. You should have a kind of idea. It was really, really low in the 60s. It became even lower in the early 70s. And then this happened. It's even worse after you've paid the rent or the mortgage, which you have to pay, otherwise you're homeless. It reaches a peak at about 1997, and then it flatlines. Nothing changes. So you might say, oh, well, that's not too bad. Think of it like high blood pressure. The UK had low blood pressure. I won't go on quite about how great the 1970s were. They weren't necessarily brilliant if you were a woman. You were paid less, a lot less. They weren't great if you were black or brown. Pakistani boys were stabbed in parks in my childhood. But they were great in terms of those people who had the most had never had so little. And those people who normally have little have never had so much. We were much more equal. For me, I'm lucky. I was born in 1968 in the county I grew up in. They abolished the 11 plus, so nobody tested me at 11. I could go to a school with everybody else who lived around me. Comprehensive education had just been introduced. Nobody really knew what a good school or a bad school was. It was pretty equal. People came from other parts of the world to see what we did. They came from Finland in particular to look at our school system. Copied it, did it slightly better, best education system in the world in Finland. People came to look at our housing system. By the late 1940s, a narrow majority of children had lived in a council house at some time. The majority. If you have a grandparent or a great-grandparent, who goes on about how they grew up in a council house, and you want to annoy them, just tell them they were normal. It wasn't special. Those houses replaced slums. So we were world-leading in terms of housing, we were world-leading in terms of education, and then we brought in the National Health Service. And our life expectancy got to almost the highest in the world by the 1960s, early 1970s. I'm not going to talk through this because I'm interested in what you say, but we have enormous amounts of data. And I'm not that good at talking to people and interviewing them, and it takes a long, long time. You've got to be very sensitive to do that. All the data we have allows us to, in effect, in a different way, talk to people, but without having to bother them because they've been interviewed. 14 million children. Imagine there's 14 million of you in this lecture theatre. And we're going to get you to quietly just talk to your neighbour. If you've got a mum and a dad, add up how much money they earn, they might not tell you, but you might have an idea. That's their income. Take away the taxes they pay, add some benefits, take away the cost of housing, work out which of the two of you in pairs is better off than the other one. One of you will have to be, so I'll try to make you slightly uncomfortable, because the English don't do this, right? And then, if say you were better off than you, you swap seats. We do that about 30 times, and we have you all arranged with the rich people there and the boys there, except you would have left the room, probably, because you won't agree to do this. So we won't do it. But you can do it statistically, you can do it in a computer. So I take all 14 million children, I take the thing called the Family Resources Survey, and I arrange the 14 million by income. I then divide it into seven groups of 2 million, and I then take the middle one of each. So I'm going to ignore the poorest million children, which includes some who are surfing, some who are homeless, a few who are in prisons, more who've got parents in prisons, ones who go to food banks. Actually very small. And I'm going to ignore the best of million out of 40 million. That's all the children in the top 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1%. That group of 1 million I'm going to ignore because they're not typical. Their families take a third of all income nationally every year. That's my group. I'm a university professor. Right, that's the group we're in, that's the group my kids are in. Not typical, not normal. And then, when I take these middle seven typical children, having ignored the extremes, we look at what they can do, what their families can do. Can they afford to decorate their homes? Do they have a holiday? Here you'll see the 36% who can't afford one. And another 5% say they don't need them. That's been rising over time. Increasingly, families say they don't need things. So they use what they have. Have they got contents insurance in case of fire or flood or theft? Can their parents save £10 a month? Can they replace furniture when it breaks? Electrical items when it breaks, of which the most important is a mobile phone. Have they got any money to spend on themselves? A treat, tight in the pub. Can they keep the house warm? Yes, almost everybody can, 93%. Can they pay the bills? 92% of people say they can pay the bills. Obviously, there are interpretations of these questions. The question, can you afford to decorate? That's what you mean by decorating. Tin of paint, £20, a brush. Or putting the pictures of the child draws in playgroup or in school up on the wall, is that decorating? Or is it granite worktop and marble slabs on the floor? Okay, so some questions are more direct than others. That's why I said to you, a holiday is a week away from home, not staying with family and friends. The UK is unusual. There aren't many of these graphs, and I've got to keep an eye on the time because I can go on, and I don't want to. This is our public spending. And that of all the other countries in Europe since 1980. We're the red line. We're a low tax, low spend economy. Your parents and your grandparents are taxed less on average than people in the rest of Europe, everywhere in the rest of Europe, and we spend less on our public services as a result than everywhere in the rest of Europe. We don't tend to talk about ourselves like that. Tax and spend has risen over the time. We're an ageing population. Some standards have increased, what we don't tolerate, what we don't allow. That big rise there is the banking crisis when we have to bail out the banks. And this is COVID. Every country in the world tells the IMF what it's going to do in the future, so we know what's happening next. We just don't tell you. You've just got to look at the spreadsheet the IMF has. I try and fail to do a right-wing version of this talk. For those who are right-wing or conservative in the audience, it must be hell on earth doing a sociology degree. So the right-wing version of the talk goes, have you seen Belgium? You don't want to go there. You know, it's just awful. It's basically communist. France, France, you know, they still want to retire at 62 or something. It's not going to work. You know, they've got that weird language they insist on speaking. Why can't they learn English? Finland, it's cold. You know, it's weird. Norway, it's little. Forget about Denmark, they're strange. They're Vikings. Austria, well, you know, Sweden, Greece, you know. Germany, it's tricky, Germany. But we can always have a go at the Germans if we try. I'm a geographer. I'm a licensed to abuse. I'm also something to come in. Well, we can't become like this. What we could try and do is love Germany. If you wanted the National Health Service working, if you wanted schools that were more efficient and better. So, what would a political manifesto look like that said we want to become like Germany? Well, we know we had one in the year 2017 and 2019. Those two manifestos of the Labour Party proposed increases in public spending that would have taken us almost exactly within 0.01% of Germany within 5 years. Impossible, intolerable, terrible, economic madness. We cannot be like Germany. And so we elected Boris Johnson. And everything was wonderful. And we came to the sunlit uplands. Anyway, the amounts of money a week in pounds that these families have, it's equivalized, that is complicated from where they are, is here, £118 for Anna's family. In that case, it's a mum and Anna, no doubt. Anna's a senior healthcare worker, her mum. £118 is equivalent to a pound a week 100 years ago. And there was a book called Around About a Pound a Week 100 years ago. So in some senses, for the poorest seventh of children, qualitatively, nothing's got better. Position of society. Food even. You can measure heights. Yes, the chances of dying is dramatically better because we don't have people dying with measles and cholera and so on anymore, but in many ways you could argue that for the very bottom seventh, things haven't got that much better over 100 years. The next seven is 237, 305, 371, 476, 633, 984 for the typical middle child of the top seven, Gemma. About £1,000 a week. That's about £52,000 a year. Gemma's got a mum and dad, so mum and dad are making £25,000 a year each after tax. They could be secondary school teachers. But Gemma's mum and dad actually run a corner shop quite efficiently. That's your posh kid in Britain. Better off than six out of seven, mother and father, £25,000 a year after paying tax. Have to pay for the mortgage. So if you, and this is certainly my upbringing, have parents who together, after tax, are bringing in more than £50,000 a year, you're in that top million. Go to university, as most of you will, go to Russellville University, go to Bristol, go to Durham, go to Exeter, and you can be average. And you'll never know that you were actually atypical, except that somebody told you once in an art theatre in Warwick that you were. Because what we do is we compare ourselves to people around us. You compare yourselves to the other children in your school. And in your classes, you'll go, oh, she's got a pony or two ponies. That one spends less, you know. You're all very polite and nice, hopefully, and understanding. The biggest inequalities in schools are in the most elite schools. St Paul's School for Girls. The differences in wealth between the parents there was absolutely enormous. They're all well off, but, you know, some have multiple homes, others mum only under £100,000, which makes you feel poor in a rich school. Go to a poor part of the country, Weston-super-Mare, and an average or poor school in Weston-super-Mare, the differences between parents and experiences are much less, except that if you're towards the bottom of that distribution, you are worrying about food. there's a big difference between going hungry and not going hungry, even if there may only be a couple of dozen pounds difference in income a week. How about the things? I'll let you read these. Stephanie Flanders, former BBC economics correspondent, and a journalist from the Financial Times. The bottom fifth of people in the UK are now poorer on average than the bottom fifth in Eastern Europe. We're a peripheral, poor country. And these are no longer, I'm not telling you anything radical. I'm not being brave. I'm not standing here going, you know, this is how it is and nobody else knows. One thing is that this is accepted, this is known now. Only in the last 5 years, I think it's really good news. Nobody, no politician now stands up and goes, Britain is doing brilliantly. They don't, they used to. They still say, oh, trust in me and do what I say and don't worry, in 10 years' time it'll be great. But not quite as they used to. In 2015, just 10 years ago, George Osborne was the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and the Chief Secretary to the Treasury was a politician called Matt Hancock. And Matt Hancock had to defend George Osborne's promise, which was that if we follow the economic plan of George, by 2030, the UK would be the richest large country in the world by per capita income. 10 years ago, politicians used to make promises like this. And now they don't, because the reality has become obvious. The cost of living crisis, which is what your teenage years live through, when your parents could buy 30% less than they could 2 years earlier, had a dramatic effect on making people realise what was happening. You can draw loads and loads of maps. This, by the way, is the E27 children look like in another way. This is Bradford and Leeds. The blue areas are more affluent, the red are more deprived. We have the sharpest, steepest social divisions in Europe, so we have the best separation maps. We had them in the past, if you've seen the booth maps of London from the 1880s, 1890s. Go back to that again. Wherever I have taught students in the universities of Newcastle, Bristol, Sheffield, Leeds, and now Oxford, some think they're poor, some think they're rich, they're all a bit embarrassed. Much more important to wear clothes that make you look normal. All my students in Muskie universities come from little blue areas. They come from Leeds, it's from there. If a student tells me they come from a city, I can almost guess the streets. Not quite, not always. It's lovely when you get surprised. But it is that kind of deterministic. There are a couple of streets in London where the majority of young people who live on those streets go to Oxford or Cambridge. In fact, the achievement is not to go if you have that ability. Let's skip that. This is probably the most important graph, and I don't want to depress you. Well, reason for optimism, when it's this bad, the only way is up. When you're the most unequal country in Europe, it could get worse. Elon Musk could get his way. They've won the US, where next? And it's not inconceivable things will get worse, but odds on most of the time, when you've done really this badly, think about the child of 30 in the class who's doing worse. On average, that child won't be the worst child in 5 years' time. But more than that, we became the second most equal large country in Europe. We had this incredible series of successes I described to you, only 40 or 50 years after being one of the worst in the past. We've been here before. We had huge inequality. 1918 was the peak. It fell in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. We get the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. People are allowed to marry people they've never been allowed to marry. Nobody had servants anymore. Servants was the most common job for women in 1918. But any inequality rises and rises and rises. We don't have servants, we just have Deliveroo. Or numerous other things where people do things for you that you don't want to do for yourself. or in the case of my city of Oxford, school teachers. Why do I call school teachers servants? Because if you're a school teacher in Oxford, you have to share a shared house with other teachers because you can't afford all on your own. You live like a student and you can never have children. One thing people really hated about being a servant was you can't have kids. So this is an amazingly good news story. Shockingly good. United Nations Children's Fund, they've done at least a dozen of these over the last 30 years. Assessments of changes in child poverty in the world. And this is the change from 2014 to 21. Look at Poland. It's massive, 40% drop. Slovenia, Latvia, Lithuania, Korea. Right? It's not all Squid Games in Korea. Okay? Or Parasite, or whatever. Estonia, Canada, Romania, Portugal, Croatia, Japan, Ireland, Malta, Greece, Belgium, New Zealand, Bulgaria, United States, even the small. Chile, it's just absolutely stunning. Finland, there we go, not much move. They're doing very well. Netherlands, flat. Then you've got some little increases, let's forget those. Then you've got Norway, a bit disappointing. Switzerland, France, and Iceland. But they actually had low rates of child poverty before, so the increase, they're still doing really well. And then hopefully you've all seen these at the top. Now, somewhere at the top, didn't have to stand out quite that badly, but your childhood was spent in the years in which the worst performing country that the United Nations measures in the world saw the biggest ever increase in child poverty. And most of those children who are poor, you have never met. Because you're in a school that brings you to an arts centre in Warwick for a talk on sociology. And that's what great inequality means. It means segregation. So a century ago, our young people were divided. And you can deliver inequality as long as people don't see it. You have to separate it. You've seen enough graphs. That's the last slide.
Why be optimistic?
One more minute. So please think of questions. An amazing thing has happened in the last 5 years, began before the pandemic. The pandemic may have helped. 2018-2019, most trade union deals on wages were flat. If you work for the Communications Workers Union, you're dealing with British Telecom, the union would negotiate a 3% increase. Inflation was about 2%. The high-paid men, almost always men, got an extra 3% of their already high salary. The lowest paid people, usually women, less likely to be white, got a 3% increase on their tiny wages. Flat increase. The last 5 years, every single trade union deal has been progressive. The highest paid workers get the least or nothing. The lowest paid workers have had the biggest increases. You can go back to 2008 and look at the civil service. Top civil servants have had a real terms fall of 25% since 2008. Lower grade civil servants, 12% less. Everybody's worse off, but the gap is narrowing. During the pandemic, we rose benefits by inflation because we had to. In the cost of living crisis, we did. Because otherwise, people would go hungry. But the gaps then reduced. Under the most right-wing conservative government we've probably ever had. Now if that isn't a reason for optimism, it's only been a few years. Last happened about 1918 after the end of the First World War. Not planned. Happens as an emergency. You can only keep on stoking up inequality so high before everything begins to fall apart. 200 schools having to close large rooms because the roofs are going to fall down. You know, other countries in Europe did not neglect their school stock like we did. Things began to fall apart, are falling apart. And it's really, really expensive to maintain inequality. So I suspect, I hope, that for the rest of your lives, you will have the experience that my granddad had. He was born in 1916. Everything became more equal almost every decade of his life, And that last bit in the 80s and the 90s, he wasn't affected too much by that because he was just retiring. And then Labour in 1997 shoved loads of money into the health service and he had a brilliant service in his last few years of death. You could well be that generation, the first since my grandfather's, to experience a society coming together. But it doesn't just happen, you know, you do have to argue for it. And the first thing you have to do is you actually have to know it's divided. If you think this is just a green and pleasant land and everybody knows their place and there's some moaning that's going on, that isn't the case. 56% of kids who've got a brother and a sister are going seriously hungry, feel full. So you can do the depressing statistics, but you can also do the change in trajectory. And the change in trajectory is occurring. The real win, and I haven't managed to do this, the real win is when you show people in the very top 1, 2, 3, 4% that their lives are dramatically better in a more equal society. They're calmer, they're happier, they're less worried about what they're going to do, how they're going to get a job. They're more free to have boyfriends and girlfriends who aren't rich. In an unequal society, you can't do that. And they can also do a job they might want to do, rather than the narrow range of jobs that's going to earn enough money so they can keep their position. And they are much less likely to feel a failure in a more equal society. If you can get that over, that the really powerful, the best of people, have a better life in a more equal society, then I think you can be secure. Thank you for letting me talk at you. Please ask me a question.
Thank you very much, Danny. Really interesting and absorbing. So I'm sure we've all got plenty of questions. Does anyone want to start off? Yes.
Mike's coming forward. So.
Thank you for your talk. My question is, how do you think inequality in the UK could be approached? It's obviously not that simple, but what could be the possible solution?
There are no simple solutions. Which annoys my colleagues when I say this, but I'll give you. Which country in Europe? I won't do the quiz, got no time. When I do this quiz, normally people guess, when I say who's had the most recent dramatic improvement in child poverty, they think Finland, Norway, wherever. The answer is Scotland. Scotland, during the pandemic and towards the end of it, introduced the Scottish Child Payment. You're under six, you get £10 a week. It's extended to, for every child under 16, their parents get £25 a week every week on top of child benefit, as long as they claim any kind of benefit. Family of three in Scotland who are in any way poor, £4,000 extra a year, split the government. Scotland has the lowest child poverty rate in the UK. Well, we don't have to go and import a model. What's the reaction of Westminster? Don't talk about Scotland. Scotland expel less than a dozen children from schools every year because they just don't do that, as they don't on the mainland. So there are so many easy solutions. There are to housing, you just go and look at what they're doing in Vienna or the Netherlands. You know, we live in a continent full of different social policies. Our problem is that we're governed and ruled by people who have been brought up to believe that inequality is good and who look to America for answers, which is not a good place to look at if you're worried about inequality. I put it as bluntly as that. You have to want it. And wanting it is difficult. If you're at the top of society, say in West London, say you work in a Guardian newspaper, say you're one of the journalists who's been working there for a length of time, you've got £120,000 a year, and you send your daughter to North London Collegiate School, which costs money, the change I'm suggesting is life-changing. You can't afford a segregated education system if you become more equal. It'll change rapidly. You can't necessarily afford that second home in France anymore. You can't have those multiple holidays, which you think are modest, because you know people who end up in Tuscany. Yeah, and it's actually, at the moment, very frightening for people in the top 10% of society to imagine a more equal country, because they don't mix. They pretend they know, they pretend they care, they don't mix, and they use their money not to mix. And it's convincing that lot. Here's Dharma. You know, goes to a segregated school as a child. He got an assisted place, I think, but it was still private. Talks about how he couldn't have gone to Leeds University without the government. Doesn't mention who paid for him to go to Oxford to do his masters, which he did. Says he's the son of a tool maker. You can Google Wadis Dharma. Wadis Dharma puts tool maker on his form as a company director. You know, Keir's life, bless him, it's like mine. It's the same posh boy. And that's the problem. It's be a bit nicer to the poor. Can we have a little bit less inequality? Can we reduce child poverty by a million by just moving children one pound over a line that nobody noticed and had no effect? But not actually could we be like Germany. And that's our problem. It's the mindset of the people with power who think that a little bit is okay. Labour support the two-child limit in England. It's unbelievable. They said they wouldn't. They will get rid of it maybe in about a year and say, aren't we nice? But this is our difficulty. Our politics moved so far to the right over those years of rising inequality that we don't have a sense of what decency actually is. Just be a bit nicer. When you get to vote in an election, your options will be not very nice, even last year. Yeah, those are the two main political parties. I suggest you vote for the not the most nasty one, but they need to change. And they did in the past. The Conservatives in the 1950s built more council houses than Labour. It's hard to imagine that is the kind of thing that they did. I promise the next answer will be short.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
One more.
I think we do have time for one more. Oh, there's lots. In fact, shall I take two together? So there's one here, and then one back at the stairs behind you. Sorry. I did that the wrong way around, didn't I? So first one here, and then if we can then take the question back there. Are you happy to answer too, Danny?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you spoke about Sunday
Child
Gemma, you mentioned that helping her parents go into the corn shop. Do you believe that the traditional idea of class, which is divided by occupation, is still relevant today?
Brilliant. What? Don't look at it very quickly. No, it's money. Although occupation correlates to money very, very highly. It used to be things like accent, religion, decorum, how you dress, all these kind of complicated things. Or, yes, you know, Mike Savage, do you know classical music? And sociologists are always trying to make class really complicated because it's a big thing in sociology. But it's money. You know, with a little bit of other things, a bit increasingly money. And you can see that when politicians don't wear ties, when they're doing the top button, when they say, call me Dave, right, all the other signifiers of class, the cultural ones, are becoming less important. But money is the ticket that allows you to do things. It's the route to freedom. And if you give people less, you're saying that you're actually worth less as a human being. It might be.
And then the lady in the black with the red scarf at the back there. Yeah, just a couple of rows up on the left.
No. Pence, there's an extreme on the far right, which is fascist and racist, where I go off stage. Well, I can't actually free, so I'm not being in that situation. But that's extreme, people who kill. I'm happy to engage in from that. The thing I try is to ask them to think of their weakest relative. I want to talk to a father at Wellington School, and that might say it was years ago now. He was old, he was 60, his boy was at Wellington School. And I said to him, it's a very expensive boarding school. I said, what are you actually paying for? And the father said, so that he'll be absolutely safe after I die. And since the father was aware he was an old father, wanted the boy to be safe, was willing to pay for his exclusive education so he'd be safe. And I said to the dad, you can't be entirely sure of that, can you? And he got very angry with me. But think outside of your own children, and most people don't have children. Think about nieces and nephews, cousins, the generations down. And think of the slightly dopey one who never gets things quite right. They should all be a dopey one you might be able to think of. And now imagine what will happen to them if Musk gets his way, if we become like the USA, just the market, privatise the NHS, forget paying $9,250 to get to university. There should be a charge for all schools, right? Imagine that kind of society to become more an equal society. And then imagine what happens to somebody you care about who finds life difficult. And that's what I try and do for people on the right. It's social policy is the ultimate safety net. But it works for health, and it works for education. So the minute you pay for those things, you're going to be more ill if you pay for healthcare. You just can't make a profit if people are well. If you pay for education, we'll lie to you. You can pay to do a degree with me. $200,000? I'll pay you anything you want as long as you're paying $200,000. Yeah? It becomes lies when you pay. Housing's difficult, but a third to a half needs to be saved, the others. But most of the small goods that you repeatedly buy and you're experienced in can be done in the private sector. That's my view. And trying to discuss, I'm very arrogant, as you can see. But that comes over well for people on the right. They respect arrogance. Trying to say, where have you put this line between what should be state and market? And is it the most efficient thing? When is the market inefficient? Take housing. We used to allocate a large proportion of housing by need, so you'd be put into the right-sized house for your family. What happens now is that many of those former council maisonettes that took two children, mum and dad, and a single professional, this will be you. 10 years' time, one of you will be in London in an ex-council flat going, it's terrible that they won't pay me more price for all the housekeepers, and I've got to rent this ex-council flat, which would have housed four people efficiently. So the market makes housing more efficient, and before you know it, you've got homeless people on the street. And it's that kind of arguments about efficiency and being rational. Where you'll lose is ideas of rank, hygiene, dirt. There are fundamental differences in the beliefs of people on the right and left. I spend more time with people on the right than the left because they're more interested. And you can predict what people on the left are going to say. You can't predict arguments on the right against what it is you think would be sensible to do. And there's a lot of the sense of we should just have order, and if I work hard, I deserve more. And it's trying to get through that.
Thank you so much, and just also on a talk of inequality, it's so refreshing and nice to hear a note of optimism and some solutions, and the importance of dialogue with people you don't agree with. So, and for a fantastic talk, thank you very much. Thank you.